Chapter 26 Rejoicing. Daughter of Zion, awake from thy sadness. Awake, for thy foes shall oppress thee no more. Bright o'er the hills dawns the day star of gladness. Arise, for the night of thy sorrow is o'er. 1897 Orders for miscellaneous writings poured in to the publisher's office, followed by countless repeat orders. The columns of the journal contained letters of appreciation for just snatches of the new book, because the copies that came through the writer's hands were all spoken for, and they would have their own copy from the next printing, or the next. 22 years earlier, science and health had emerged into a hostile world. The same evil that burned William Tyndale at the stake for daring to translate the sacred scriptures into English had struck fiercely at the woman and her child. But the child, quote, was caught up unto God and to his throne, end quote, and had been at work in human consciousness for the ensuing 2 decades and more. And though the woman had fled into the wilderness and had been on the cross these weary long years, an appreciation of her great work and life had begun to develop. Nowhere was this more apparent than in the hundreds of letters of gratitude for miscellaneous writings, a few of which appeared in the journal in the spring and summer of 1897. And none of these appreciative letters expressed more understanding than this one from Chicago. Dearly beloved mother, we are having a sweet rejoicing over the dear book, which has come to us direct from your hand and from the patient, overbrooding love which ever extends its sheltering wing to warm and comfort the struggling hearts of your students and of all mankind. Having been one of those who urged upon you the publication of miscellaneous writings, I may say that I appreciated it somewhat long before it was published. But now that hope has become fruition, and this volume and its priceless utterances is before us with its wise precepts, its tender admonitions, and loving warnings and entreaties, with its rules for solving hard problems and dissolving hard hearts, I see that my imagination never touched a full appreciation of this manual of right living, and I learn that concerning the things of God, realization is far more satisfying than anticipation. To me, these articles seem to be as milestones, marking the progress over the rugged pathway of an experience that has included all of the stings, persecutions, and dire oppression of a most outrageous fortune. A pathway often bedewed with tears or flooded by the torrents of unspeakable evil that have poured themselves out upon your devoted head. But they also assure us that the progress was made, and that in the midst of all these years, when evil has seemed real and trials so hard to bear, God's grace has been sufficient for thee. Viewing from afar off, such a holy ministry as yours has been with its countless achievements, and having gained but a small sense of the sustaining power of the divine presence, it is no wonder that it appears to me as the miracle of centuries that you should have continued faithful when beset by such appalling odds. This book contains the flower and fruitage of a consecrated and sanctified husbandry, and its aroma, rising heavenward, will perfume the ascending journey of the race, until all shall awake in his likeness and be satisfied. To say that I thank you would be very tame and inadequate, in view of the fact that I should not today be manifesting a sense of life on earth if it had not been for the demonstration of Christian Science by you and the teaching which was pursued at the cost of such interminable sacrifices. Hoping that I may become more worthy of a place in the kinship of those who are watching with you in this hour, I sign myself with loving gratitude. Your affectionate student, Edward A. Kimball. Another appreciative letter stated, quote, "We seem almost overwhelmed with blessings. So thick and fast have you been pouring in upon us the past year." End quote. Christian Science was emerging from the stage of persecution to the stage of popularity, and there was great rejoicing within the ranks. But the mother heart did not feel the jubilation that was sweeping the field. To her student, Marjorie Coles, in London, she wrote, "Darling, when will my hour come? The students seems to have come already. They have less and less to combat, while I seem to have more and more because of their prosperity. Evil would revenge on me for the prosperity of our cause, but love is greater than all." About the time the new book was being launched upon its mission, the leader received an appeal from Benny to help him out of his difficulties in Philadelphia. This time, she did not intercede in his behalf, but wrote, quote, "You conceal from me all you should tell, and then, when you get into difficulty, come to me for help," end quote. Though she was the mother to the whole world, her experience with Benny pointed up the fact that a time comes when the mother must withdraw her support and let the child stand alone. That time had come for Foster Eddy, and when the Philadelphia church voted to expel him from office, his mother wrote him that he did not have permission to come back to Pleasant View. Her heartaches were not ended, and neither was her labor. The time had arrived for the republication of Christ in Christmas, and in considering this, she was also considering a new design for the final illustration. In this regard, she wrote to James Gilman, "Now I suggest this picture for you to draw that possesses my thought of the way. Make the ground cross the same size as the one already made, and the earth and this cross dark, and without flowers or birds. Then rise on an incline, and put the singing birds and the flowers and the dove with an olive branch in its bill on the second cross, and have this cross lighter in shade than the lower one and smaller. Make the crown still fainter in form, but distinct. Put the top of it in line with the top of the plate, thus giving the thought that all matter disappears with the crown or crowned thought. Make the star's radiance less solid and blunt. Outline it as a shimmer, not a shower of light, and suited to the upper skies that you have made much to my liking. Many could benefit from this instruction to Mr. Gilman and waken to the realization that spiritual things are not hazy, misty, or indistinct, but are light, clear, and distinct. After some chastening experiences, Mr. Gilman brought forth a satisfactory illustration. But interestingly, it was not included in the third edition of Christ in Christmas, which appeared late in 1897. Both artists had seen in the sixth picture, Christian Science Healing, some aspects that James Gilman felt he could improve upon. So, after the completion of The Way, Mrs. Eddy asked him to undertake this task. James had made much progress spiritward since 1893, and his concept and appreciation of the founder had grown apace. Consequently, the woman in his new rendition was transformed from an earthly to a heavenly being. When he sent the finished picture to Mrs. Eddy late in April, she was deeply moved. The fact that she had looked over the entire audience and not seen a single Christian Scientist when she first spoke in the Mother Church gives much significance to her response to Mr. Gilman at this time. April 30th, 1897. Mr. Gilman, Christian Scientist. My dear friend, do you know what you have done for yourself, for mankind, for our cause? No, you do not, perhaps, but I will tell you. You have illustrated and interpreted my life on the plate that you sent me. Mary Baker Eddy. While one Christian Scientist was working on Christian Science Healing for Christ in Christmas, the field was concerned with a notice in the April journal. Notice. Note. All the churches of our denomination are respectfully requested to have the first reader read the following at the opening of the Bible lesson Sunday. Mary Baker Eddy. The Bible and the Christian Science textbook are our only preachers. We shall now read scriptural texts and their correlative passages from our textbook. These comprise our sermon. The canonical writings, together with the word of our textbook, corroborating and explaining the Bible texts in their denomination, spiritual import and application to all ages, past, present, and future, constitute a sermon undivorced from truth, uncontaminated or fettered by human hypotheses, and authorized by Christ. The number of our Sunday lessons and the scripture they contain follow the international series. This explanatory note was slightly revised in May and has seen other slight revisions since then, but in its essentials, it remains the same. The students were convinced that Mother's actions were authorized by Christ and new students were turning to this teaching by the hundreds. But those who were resisting and denying her Christly teaching were aiming bitter words and deadly blows at the founder. Mrs. Eddy answered one such attack on the first page of the May Journal. Question and answer. Quote, "Is Mrs. Josephine Curtis Woodbury your friend?" End quote. "She tries to make the public believe that she is my friend, but I do not regard her thus. It was only on March 16, 1896, and after I had done all that the rules and bylaws of my church in Boston allow for admitting her a second time into this church, that her scribe sent to me a most abusive letter, which I now have and which I was informed had been made public. Later came another letter from the same source, in which I was threatened with a lawsuit in April 1896 unless I did more for Mrs. Woodbury, and unless I did what that letter demanded. I never tried to harm her, although her scribe alleges that I have. But I did earnestly try to benefit her, even as I would love my enemies. Mary Baker G. Eddy." While the prosperity and rejoicing were largely for the students, there was an article in the May Journal that did rejoice the mother's heart. It was, quote, "What made a Baptist minister a Christian Scientist?" End quote. By Reverend George Tompkins, D.D., C.S. Reverend Tompkins had studied in Mrs. Laura Lathrop's New York Christian Science Institute the previous December, while occupying the Baptist pulpit each Sunday. In his words, quote, "The God thought in Christian Science appeared as far as the heavens are above the earth, over the materializing teaching and tendencies of existing creeds. Henceforth, my duty was clear. Cut the shorelines. Burn the bridges." End quote. Reverend Irving C. Tomlinson, a Universalist minister, had recently studied with Flavia Knapp and taken science and health into his pulpit, healing one, astonishing all, and displeasing many. He too had cut the shorelines and joined the ranks of the scientists. An article by Tomlinson appeared in the June Journal, and he was one of the 1,400 new members admitted to the Mother Church on the next Communion Day, Sunday, July 4th. Christian Science was coming of age. It would be 21 years on the 4th of July since Mrs. Eddy, with six of her students, had established the Christian Scientist Association. Perhaps that was in her thought on June 30th, when she wrote the following invitation to be read on July 4th in her church. "My beloved church, I invite you one and all to Pleasant View, Concord, New Hampshire, on July 5th at 12:30 p.m., if you would enjoy so long a trip for so small a purpose as simply seeing Mother. My precious busy bees, under 12 years of age, are requested to visit me at a later date, which I hope soon to name to them. With love, Mother." Mary Baker Eddy. Independence Day was celebrated on Monday, July 5th, in 1897, and the leader had most graciously excluded the children in her invitation for this holiday celebration. Read at the close of the communion service, this invitation was a delightful surprise to many, but much of the congregation, which was exceptionally large, was expectant, because the press had already announced the coming event. Special invitations had also been sent earlier to a number of individuals, quote, from the Pacific to the Atlantic shore, from the Palmetto to the Pine Tree State, end quote. Edward Bates received his invitation in Boston late Friday afternoon, together with the mother's request that he prepare trains for transportation. Early the next morning, he made arrangements for two special trains of 12 cars each to leave Boston Monday morning at 9 and 9:15 a.m. For such a large number, the railroad would have to print special half-fare tickets, which would be ready at 8 a.m. on Monday. Mr. Bates learned through inquiry that the ticket seller could sell 400 tickets in an hour if he had no other trains, but that he always had a great many trains. Here was a conundrum. 1 hour in which to sell 3 or 4 times as many tickets as they could sell in that time. Mr. Bates spent the weekend with this problem, but he was convinced that anything Mrs. Eddy requested was capable of fulfillment. By Monday morning, he had a plan for his own booth in the Midway. At 8 o'clock, I had 5 bank cashiers on the ground to handle the money, 5 other gentlemen to hand out the tickets, and 6 or 8 to pass the tickets to the students. Every few minutes, I carried $400 or $500 to the ticket office and returned with a large bunch of tickets. At 8:40, we had sold nearly all the tickets. The conductors on both trains expressed to everyone their surprise and satisfaction. Quote, "It was the best crowd and the easiest excursion we ever looked after," end quote. The Boston Globe reported that, quote, "It was a remarkable gathering of men and women and one baby that left the station," end quote, on a frightfully hot day. As the Boston trains arrived at Concord, trains and every other type of conveyance were arriving from every direction, and before the appointed hour, between 2,500 and 3,000 people were assembled on the lawns at Pleasant View. The first paragraph in the August Journal stated, "A memorable 4th of July indeed will be that of Anno Domini 1897 in the annals of Christian Science. We deem it not boastful to say that never was assembled in celebration of any nation's natal day a more devout or thankful set of people than those who gathered in Concord at Concord on July 5th last. In Concord, what a contrast between this orderly gathering and the pressing crowds that had thronged the leader in Chicago 9 years earlier. The founder had brought order out of chaos. Speakers and honored guests were seated on the piazza when Mr. Bates brought Mrs. Eddy out, whereupon the crowd united in three spontaneous cheers of joy, which she acknowledged graciously with a smile and a bow. The Globe reporter wrote, quote, "One look at her pale, motherly, spiritual face is enough. That face made a deep impression on all who saw it yesterday, and was the reward which these pilgrims got for their long journey in the blazing heat." End quote. Mr. Bates acted as master of ceremonies, introducing first Mayor Woodworth of Concord, and then Mrs. Eddy. The students drank in her every word, and those words continue to uplift students today from the pages of miscellaneous writings, with only slight changes from their first utterance. Think of this, heaven right here, where angels are men, clothed more lightly, and men as angels, who burdened for an hour, spring into liberty, and the good they would do, they do, and the evil they would not do, they do not. The several speakers that followed Mrs. Eddy included, among many others, three ex-clergymen, the Reverends Tompkins, Tomlinson, and Mackenzie. One sad omission was that of two outstandingly fine Concord attorneys. Mrs. Eddy had intended introducing these gentlemen herself, but an unfortunate circumstance plus shortage of time deprived the audience of hearing General F.S. Streeter and Reuben E. Walker. At a later date, Mrs. Eddy said of the latter, "When the Boston attorneys failed to find a law by which our church could obtain a charter, I called in the services of the Honorable Reuben Walker, now judge of the Supreme Court of the state of New Hampshire. I asked him to find for us a law to fit the case. He said that he knew of no such law upon the statute books. I asked him upon what was human law based. He reflected and then said, quote, upon the divine law. But, he said, if the Massachusetts abstractor of law can find no such statute, how can I? End quote. To this I replied, quote, God has somewhere provided such a law, and I know you can find it. End quote. 3 days later, my secretary visited him and found him lost in a pile of law books he had been examining. His greeting was, quote, I have found the law. End quote. It was a statute which was enacted to suit the needs of the Methodist Church and fully met our requirements. At the Independence Day celebration at Pleasant View, after the literary exercises were over, the guests looked about over the spacious and beautiful grounds surrounding the mother's peaceful residence, refreshing themselves with lemonade provided for them by her, and served in the shade of a fine group of trees at one end of the grounds. Christian Science Journal. Though one baby came on the train from Boston to this adult gathering, there were at least two other children present. Mrs. Jessie Cooper had traveled all the way from Kansas City with her 9-year-old son and 7-year-old daughter, the latter having suffered for several days from a boil on her head, which, despite her mother's work, was much enlarged and inflamed that Monday morning. Following the exercises, Mrs. Cooper and her children got in the line of people who passed through the porte cochere to be greeted by the mother, who sat on the porch. Perhaps others had similar experiences, but Mrs. Cooper's account was recorded and has been preserved. I wish I could make the world know what I saw when Mrs. Eddy looked at those children. It was a revelation to me. I saw for the first time the real mother love, and I knew that I did not have it. I had a strange, agonized sense of being absolutely cut off from the children. It is impossible to put into words what the uncovering of my own lack of real mother love meant to me. As I turned in the procession and walked toward the line of trees in the front of the yard, there was a bird sitting on the limb of a tree, and I saw the same love poured out on that bird that I had seen flow from Mrs. Eddy to my children. I looked down at the grass and the flowers, and there was the same love resting on them. It is difficult for me to put into words what I saw. This love was everywhere, like the light, but it was divine, not mere human affection. I looked at the people milling around on the lawn, and I saw it poured out on them. I thought of the various discords in this field, and I saw for the first time the absolute unreality of everything but this infinite love. It was not only everywhere present, like the light, but it was an intelligent presence that spoke to me, and I found myself weeping as I walked back and forth under the trees and saying out loud, "Why did I never know you before? Why have I not known you always?" When we got back to the hotel, there was no boil on my child's head. It was just as flat as the back of her hand. That joyous assemblage, the recipients of Mrs. Eddy's boundless love, had no idea that such a gathering was a trial for the leader. But the mother's trials resulted in triumphs which blessed all. To the Boston Herald reporter, quote, "She was the picture of health and energy for a lady of her years," end quote. The Boston Globe stated, "The profile is sharp and keen, and the face in full view is extremely delicate and tender. Motherly more nearly expresses it. She wore a royal purple silk dress covered with black lace. Over her silver-white hair was a dainty bonnet. On her breast was a cross of diamonds, the one important ornament she wore." Appropriate for the occasion was her beautiful and costly badge of ruby and diamonds, emblem of the Daughters of the Revolution, which she also wore. But the fact that the Globe reporter saw only the cross is interesting. Some of the scientists noticed another sign of struggle, for although she did not use them, she had a pair of eyeglasses hanging from a gold pin on her gown. Her address was delivered in her usual calm, dignified, and impressive way. and none suspected that she had prepared a speech to read. But the following day she wrote to the Hannahs that she had been under such a fire as never before, prior to the gathering, and at the last moment had prepared a speech to read, a thing I have not done in many years. The leader needed help, but the rejoicing students were as unaware of it as they were of the malpractitioner's law, that they could do nothing to help her. Following this holiday celebration, their joy proliferated in the building and dedicating of churches, widening the gulf between the founder and her followers. They were going one direction, while she was going another, but they could not yet see the pathway of the leader. Perhaps the students needed worldly success and acclaim before their aspirations became heavenly. Nonetheless, their pursuit of worldly ways was a great burden on the founder, as is evident in her letter of August 7th to Julia Field King. My life is a perpetual slavery to the world, and it is a hard matter. So much the students demand of me, and yet I need help above all persons on earth in everything but Christian Science. But the law is not yet broken by them, that they can do nothing for me. So I have the care of my house, my grounds, my clothes, my entire mass of what I despise and want to lose sight of. Presents are sent to me in profusion, but they are not what I need. May God give me grace to live. Once again, the leader was alone, blazing the way, while the students were rejoicing in their largely material concept of spiritual science. They thought they had overcome the world because they had won the first battle, whereas the war had just begun. None knew better than the lone mother what lay ahead. But in 1897, the scientists seemed to be on a limitless plateau of rejoicing. So the mother turned back to encourage them in the steps they were taking and to rejoice with them.